welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Jason Gregory, who is the author of Fasting the Mind, Spiritual Exercises for Psychic Detox. Jason is a teacher and international speaker specializing in the fields of Eastern and Western philosophy, comparative religion, metaphysics, and ancient cultures. He's also the author of The Science and Practice of Humility and Enlightenment Now. Welcome, Jason. I understand you're calling in from Thailand.
Yeah, I am. It's great to be on, Dr. Kolb. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, would you like to give the listening audience a little bit of your background and how you came to write the book?
Sure, yeah. Well, I've been, most of my adult life, I've been living in Asia, and I've been studying a lot of the ancient Eastern traditions, anywhere from Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, and some Western philosophy, but mainly living over here and visiting the temples, the monasteries, the ashrams. And yeah, I've lived in India, Nepal, Thailand. Currently, I'm in Thailand. And yeah, the impetus behind the book is really usually the same for all of my previous books, but this one was about synthesizing probably the core practice of a lot of the ancient Eastern traditions and making it palatable for the modern world, which is the lifestyle practice and method of fasting the mind. So, yeah, I never really had a to explain to your listeners, I never really had an aha moment, as a lot of other teachers and that usually say that they have. Mine was just kind of a natural progression from living over here and meeting great teachers and knowing a lot of students of different philosophies and basically just diving into it head first and not looking back.
Well, your book does go into a great deal of history about the different ancient, I mean, well before the time of Christ, the ancient history, and how many of the great philosophers were born, you know, during the same time period. So they kind of helped each other and you know, together crystallize more of what they were trying to bring to the world. Would you like to talk a little bit about the Confucius and Lao Tzu time and what that brought to the world?
Definitely. Well, yeah, that was an interesting epoch of time, because even if you look at all around the world, I mean, you had at that same specific time, you had Pythagoras, Gautama the Buddha, Lao Tzu and Confucius. So they all brought their own unique philosophy, but there was an undercurrent there between them. But when we look at specifically at Confucius and Lao Tzu, there's, you know, Confucius was very, what would we say, very analytical, very intellectual, and mm-hmm. his idea of bringing what we would call the Tao or the universal order to the world was often through structure and discipline and building mm-hmm. a society that nurtures that. While Lao Tzu would kind of scoff at that, and he would say, you know, what rubbish, you know, the Tao is natural to all of us. It's not something we have to induce. It's something that we sort of have to come back in alignment with. Right. It's kind of that the reason we lost contact with that is kind of because, you know, our lives have become so busy and too intellectual almost. And we don't have an appreciation for nature and so forth and so on. And, you know, the Tao is actually means the way or the way of nature. And right. So Lao Tzu never really lost the understanding that human beings are a part of nature as well. Where maybe I wouldn't say that Confucius lost that understanding, but his way of seeing the universe was kind of like, you know, we need to kind of induce the Tao in the world. We need to become a superior man and so mm-hmm. forth and so on. So there was that those two different sort of views of reality. And I guess that if you look at the Confucian way, it's not totally absurd. You know, if you do adhere to a certain philosophy or a certain structure, sometimes that does, you know, have an effect on your ego and it makes you less self-interested and so forth and so on. But right. There are other problems, you know, when you do follow that certain philosophy.
I would say growing up in the Western world, one of the biggest way we get away from the Tao is because we don't engage our feeling nature. You know, we're taught in school and in society in general to think things through more in the mental realm, and we don't feel. So if we have a choice to make, we may analyze it mentally but not feel in each direction. Because usually when you have your feeling nature intact and you feel one way versus another way, you'll definitely get guidance. But that's from the heart, and people aren't centered in their heart in the Western world. I mean, I think in the Eastern world, they're more centered there.
Definitely, you're exactly right. And I think that, you know, from living over here for most of my adult life, like, I've been really moved, especially in India, where I go to rural places. There's a particular place called Tiruvannamalai I really enjoy in South India, and the people there are so simple. There's a really great sense of community, and you can just tell by the people. Like, they do have some central pillars that bind the community. Like, there is Hinduism, and there was a great sage there called Ramana Maharishi, and so forth and so on. That kind of binds the community. But when I see them interact and so forth and so on, they're really heart-centered, and they understand each other. And even when I've seen, for example, two men would get into an argument, I've seen this a lot. I go to this particular tea shop and I see men, you know, they're busy, they're working, they get into an argument. But it's amazing that, like, 5 minutes later, they're talking as if nothing ever happened. I mention to a lot of people I take there, it's kind of like, no disrespect to the Indians, but it's kind of like dog psychology, because, you know, dogs can get into a big argument.
Right, and then they're going to play.
Yeah, and they're going to play.
That's true.
And it's quite amazing. I think that we're missing out on that in the West because, as you were saying, we're too much in the head. And, you know, if we get in an argument, it's like, oh, you know, Susan did wrong by me. That's it. Like, I'm not talking to her for a week or two at least, you know.
Sometimes 20 years later, like you said in your book, 20 years later, all you can think is that one bad thing I did to you, you know. Get past it 20 years later. And you say, in the meantime, I might have really evolved and become a wonderful person, but you can't see that because 20 years ago, I took some of your money or something, you know.
Yeah. It's amazing because that is a real phenomenon, that what I do mention in the book. It's that one negative experience will crowd out all of the great times we had together, you know, all of the great conversations and everything. And this is like what they call in psychology the negativity bias, you know. It might be a evolutionary thing, but it's kind of ridiculous in our modern world to kind of to keep that mentality, because, you know, one bad experience cannot cancel out, you know, a lifetime of good experiences. But we see it often. And like I did mention in the book, that one small bad experience, 20 years later, I'll still see the person, or anyone will see that person and go, oh, I remember what they were like. And it's like,
yeah, I'm not dealing with them again.
And they've had a whole evolution that you don't even know about, you know.
Right. And it really does harden the heart, you know. I'm a doctor, obviously, a plastic surgeon, and I see people with hardened hearts, you know, who really take every little thing personally or as an affront. They do have a much more likely tendency to develop heart disease. And then people who are extreme victims can often develop cancer. That doesn't mean that everybody with cancer is a victim, but because, like, regular smart meters and toxins and radiation can cause cancer too. But in general, if you tend to become a victim at every turn, you're much more at risk for cancer. And if you tend to harden your heart, you're much more at risk for heart disease.
Wow, that's interesting, isn't it? And it makes complete sense. It makes complete sense. It's and I think that it's, you know, it's a characteristic of Western culture. We cannot open up the heart to each other, you know, not even, in some cases, not even to our families and friends. So it's becoming that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. It's becoming a kind of a cultural epidemic with us at the moment in the West.
Well, I think your book is excellent in terms of explaining what kind of practices and even pitfalls to avoid in this search for what I would call I call it kind of walking in meditation, because all of us on the spiritual path meditate, but how many of us can really walk in meditation, and even when there's a problem in surgery or a problem, you know, with a patient or a problem with a, with an employee, how can you still keep that mind blank and kind of calm so that you can get information that is so important for the correct action? As soon as we start thinking ourselves, then, of course, the mind is not blank. And I depend on spiritual guidance for all sorts of stuff. And so I tend to not have my mind going all the time. And I realized that because a friend of mine was always asking me, what was I thinking? And I realized I really wasn't thinking anything, you know, when he was asking. And I would realize, well, I wasn't thinking anything. And that's really how you walk in meditation, is you don't, you walk with a clear mind, no thought, and then your the impressions that you're getting from the higher dimensions are great information. I mean, just really helpful information. And then you can navigate through difficult situations with great success.
Yeah, for sure. I like what you said, because the thing is, like, Sadhguru once said this in India. He's a famous spiritual teacher. He said that, you know, there's a lot of people who practice meditation in the world, but there's few who have a meditative state of consciousness.
Right.
So
right.
That walking in meditation, as you said, like that, and you can and you can actually see it in particular people's faces. You know, there's that sense of, I wouldn't say bliss, but kind of a
calm.
Calm, not a blankness. It's an emptiness,
right.
But it's a calm, you know, and like you said, it affects everything. It affects your work. It affects your conversations and the way you approach life. And, you know, a lot of people are starting to see the benefits of just the practice of meditation, because they see when you practice meditation for extensive periods of time, I mean, many years, that you start to embody this meditative calm. And, you know, I mentioned in the book, there's a couple of, you know, key terms. There's in Sanskrit, they have vairagya, which means non-reaction, and viveka, which means kind of mental discernment. So, you know, you gain these two tools. You know, they talk about this in the Hindu philosophy of Vedanta a lot, that when you start to have this meditative state of consciousness, when the problems, you know, the obstacles invariably will pop up in life, but because you have this meditative state of consciousness, you don't react as you used to react, you know, very, very emotional and unconscious. Mm-hmm. You become much more conscious, because you can actually see your mind, you know, and see obviously the subconscious content of your mind wanting to react a certain way, but you have a much more firm, empty state and clarity that you can see that in, and it affects, you know, your relationships, your ordinary life, your working life. And, yeah.
I'll give you an example with surgery that happened the other day. There was this patient who was really, really wanting to see me, because I wrote the book on the problems with breast implants, and I was holistic, and she was holistic, and she was even here in town. And so she came in, and we had a consultation that seemed to go fine. But in the middle of the consultation, a police officer showed up. And as you know, police officers don't wait. They want to talk to you when they show up. I had reported a theft that they came to investigate. And so I went out for 10 minutes, and I talked to him about the theft, and then I went back in. And the theft really was nothing, because I had already gotten the stuff back through another means, you know. But I had to report the theft because that's what I was guided to do, you know, because that's part of what, you know, my guidance was. So I wasn't upset about the theft. But she canceled the surgery with me because she said I was distracted for the rest of the thing, which I wasn't. I spent extra time answering. Her husband had like 1,000 questions. I answered all the questions. I continued to give them all of my energy and love and, you know, concern and answer to everything. And then she decided to cancel surgery. Now, so the manager got upset because, of course, she's looking at the money, right? And I kind of laughed, because what I heard is that she was going to have a complication on induction. And we've been in business here since 95, and we've never even cracked the crash cart. And Spirit did not want me to have a problem with a patient during anesthesia. Isn't that wild? See, so I'm not upset she canceled. It's fine. It's in divine order. But whenever things happen, you just have to ask what's going on, and you can find out, and then you won't be upset about it, because it's really usually for your protection.
Exactly. And it's that, That's a great example, and a lot of people, you know, I think they overanalyze their life a lot. Like a certain situation will happen, like what you had, and they will lose mm-hmm. it, and they won't even see
get
upon
angry
self.
Yeah. I didn't get angry at all. I kind of laughed about it. I said, okay, well, you know, I don't want problems. You know, I really don't want problems. I like to be able to tell people that we've never had problems here. You know, we've never cracked the crash code, and that makes them feel better. You know, because people are afraid of surgery. You know, they have fear. But when we can tell them that, then they have less fear.
Exactly. Well, you know, if we reflect on most things in our life, we can see that there is that order within that process. You know, and mm-hmm. a lot of people don't self-reflect. But when we do, we can see why certain things have happened in our life, even if they were a terrible situation at that point in time. But you know, you can mm-hmm. look back and you can go, wow, that's, you know, I'm here now because of that experience. And
right,
you know, and but that's not something that we're trained to do, is it?
No, but like, say you go out and there's a horrible traffic accident and you spend, like, you know, 30 minutes just sitting there, you know, you might say that that's a horrible thing, but you know, when you ask about it, there are always good things about that. You know, it's like almost even the little things, like getting caught in traffic, or, I mean, not just the big things, but even the little things. If you really ask for information with a quiet mind, this is what you have to do. You have to have the mind that can just receive information. Then you will find that most things are actually for your protection.
That's exactly. And, you know, even if you are stuck in traffic like that, it's also another good time to practice, you know, being calm.
Yeah, while you're in the car. Exactly. Yeah. I do. I mean, I love the time in the car that you can just zone out and have a fasting mind.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sometimes we actually need to be put in that situation to slow down sometimes too,
because exactly.
like, we can be so busy.
That's right. And I think sometimes that does happen, to give us a chance to blank the mind, to fast the mind, so that perhaps some very important piece of information needs to come in. You probably have the same thing I do. When you first wake up in the morning, a lot of the impressions that you get are very, very important impressions. And you might get warnings about things that might not go right. You might get, you know, it's right when you wake up is the time to really, those fleeting thoughts can be very, very important. And if you, the more you meditate, the less fleeting they are. You know, they seem to slow down, so you can actually grab them.
Definitely. Yeah, I get that actually before bed as well sometimes. You
do
know,
you?
It can be a bit annoying because I'm trying to go to sleep and it's like, right. I get the notepad out, I better put that down. But
right.
I also get that. Yeah. I also get that when you probably do as well, but when I go for a long walk, you know, the mm-hmm. mind is very calm, and then
right.
things just naturally arise, you know,
mm-hmm.
You know, that maybe it's a situation that you've been trying to deal with, or maybe it's it's usually, you know, I'm in a part of a book that I need to, what's the transitional period? So I go for a long walk, and then, you know, the answers just come to you, you know.
Right.
But you need to calm the mind down to actually get there. You can't get it through,
no.
you know, beating your head up against
it. Yeah, you can't force it, right?
No.
That's true, yeah. Well, that's called writer's block, you know, when you are totally like unable to bring in anything. And it's funny, we have a great energy in our waiting room, and we have these two very large amethyst geodes, and several people have told me that they come in and just sit next to the geode so they can write. They're writers. they've discovered that it really, different places really do have a different energy.
yeah, definitely.
So give us a little bit more information about the historical, the historical times in, say, India, that contributed to your ideas of fasting the mind. Because I know there were some that came from India.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you have to go way, way back. You know, if we look at the Dravidian culture, which we can go back to probably, you know, a lot of historians say about 2500 BCE, and that was a kind of a culture that probably lived before that, but from 2500 to 1500 they were basically on their own. But then what happened was that you had the Aryan civilization that swept in from the north in the mm-hmm. the Indus Valley region, which it kind of covers northeastern Afghanistan, Pakistan, and kind of northwestern India. So you had this kind of this Indus Valley civilization, and you had this mixing of two cultures where you had the Dravidians and the Aryans, and that became the famous Vedic culture. And basically that's the birth seed of modern day Hinduism, what we see today.
Right.
So, and what happened was that the Aryans, when they came in, they were, I think, a bit more of a intellectual race of people. And what happened was that they kind of developed a social system, which was what we now know as the Hindu caste system. Mm-hmm. And so in the upper two, they kind of congregated in the upper two classes, so the warrior caste and the priestly caste, while the Dravidians, they populated the lower two castes, which was the peasant class and the commerce or merchant class. And mm-hmm. and basically the Brahmin class, which is the priestly class, the Aryans was practicing a lot of they're from their ancient tradition, they used to practice a lot of sacrifices and other sorts of rituals. And mm-hmm. they actually took there was a spoken language amongst the Dravidians, and this became the hymns of the Vedas, actually. And so to cut a long story short, that the Brahmin class, which was the Aryans, they were practicing these hymns, and they could feel a sense of the Tao, which we were talking about, but they would call it Brahman. And mm-hmm. they thought that energy was only in the ritual. So
right,
and they yeah. thought they thought they were very they felt very peaceful and everything like that. Mm-hmm. So, but then after a while, they started to realize what you mentioned before, Susan, which was they started to feel this meditative state of consciousness in ordinary life. They could sense this greater sense of unity just mm-hmm. in walking and going to the bathroom and everything. So
right.
we had the original, what they call the Vanaprasthas, which became the forest sages or the forest original worldly renouncers, you could say. And so they went to the forest, and what happened was that there was a practice that happened from all of this, which was neti, it's called in Sanskrit, which is that's translated as not this, not this, or neither this nor that. And the Vanaprasthas, they left the world because they thought that they needed to leave the world, to renounce the physical world, to have this feeling, that meditative state of consciousness or Brahman, that sense within them. But then they realized that it was actually, they didn't need to renounce the physical world. They actually need to renounce their own mind. They need to renounce the contents, their own sort of personality that kept them bound to suffering and so forth and so on. So
their mental chatter.
Yeah, their mental chatter. So this practice of neti-neti allowed them to do that because they could realize, and neti-neti, you need to, in the modern day, a lot of people use that in the sense of not the body, but the original context was it's not the mind, not this, not this. So,
right.
you know, I'm identifying with someone doing bad to me, but I'm actually not this that's angry about it. And, you know,
right.
we could go deeper into that. But, you know, that's the kind of one of the original fasting the mind practices. It went way back to the Vanaprasthas, and ironically the Vanaprasthas returned to society to live with society and continue to practice this form of mental renunciation. So that's kind of like a brief historical view of that Vedic civilization, and that's one of, you know, obviously that's the birth seed of a lot of the spiritual practices we see in India today, and you know, a lot of Western people are actually attracted to those as well.
So in India, would you say that there are more people practicing that method, or more people actually, you know, renunciation of all the physical stuff and, you know, going to the cave and not interacting with society? Do you think both exist now?
Yeah, both exist. There's a lot that exists in India, actually. The predominant practice is what we call bhakti in Sanskrit, which is just devotional love to God or to mm-hmm. Brahman over there.
Right.
So the majority of people practice that because they realize – well, not that they realize. They're just common people like most people. They have a job. I mean, I don't know everybody, but that's kind of – you know, they think – well – nothing against it, but they just believe that if they have a little shrine in their home and they, you know, pray to Shiva or Vishnu every day, mm-hmm. and, you know, they still do practice meditation, that's their spiritual path, actually. But mm-hmm. then you get the other groups. So you get the what you just mentioned. You have the physical worldly renouncers, and then you have the ones who will live in society but close to society but very simply and just practice mental renunciation. I actually think that in India in general, because most people are bhakti, and you know, they see physical stuff. I mean, they value physical world a lot as well, that they see a lot of the physical worldly renouncers, and I think they respect them maybe a lot more than just like a swami, for example. A swami is kind of a mental renouncer because right. they still learn intellectually, but they mm-hmm. they're training their mind actively in ashrams and that to renounce their mind, while mm-hmm. you know, that same place I mentioned to you before, Tiruvannamalai, there's a lot of sadhus that live around the holy mountain of Arunachala, and they're great people. I've a lot of sadhu friends, but they just basically just live in the forest or beside the road, and people think they're beggars, but they actually choose that life. So I'd say it's a big mix, but the predominant spiritual practice, well, you know, India is a big country, would be devotional love to Shiva or Vishnu.
Right. So what do you think the influence has been on the West? You know, there's been a number of, I guess, Yogananda came over, and the Maharishi, and those were earlier, I guess, in the 60s and 70s. Ram Dass, you know, had influence on us when we were young. Do you think that a lot of that has been kind of shared with the West, so that if you were born in the West, you had the opportunity to at least know about it and experience it?
I feel so, yeah. I feel that it was intentionally shared with the West. There was a couple of – I can't remember which teacher it was, but they were actually told – I think it was – I think Sri Yukteswar told Yogananda specifically to go to the West.
Yeah, that's correct.
And teach them – not only yoga, but Vedanta, right. like what I've been talking about, the fasting the mind method and so forth and so on, like just having the being conscious of mm-hmm. the mind. So, yeah, I feel that there's a lot of an deliberate intention to try and influence Western culture. Mm-hmm. Even in the modern day, like when you hear Sadhguru speak, you know, he has a few centers in the US, but when I hear him speak in India, he talks a lot about how what they're talking about there in that small community in southern India that mm-hmm. needs to be shared with people in the Western world, you know, because he will often say that, you know, a lot of our tendency in the Western world is to try and be somebody all the time, try to be special, mm-hmm. and actually a lot of the grounding in life comes when you understand that, you know, you are special to a certain degree, but in a greater context, your personality is also not that special. You know, mm-hmm. it's a fleeting, brief, temporary moment in the universe. But your deep down nature is what's important.
Eternal,
you know?
Right?
It is eternal. You know, so you know, he often talks about this, and I think that that's what a lot of the teachers tried to bring over into Western culture, mm-hmm. And I think they've done a good job. But I also think that there's a lot of people have kind of taken that sort of knowledge, taken advantage of that knowledge, and also mm-hmm. some people have misunderstood that knowledge too in the West. And that can happen because it also happens in India as well. People misunderstand it and take it their own way and don't realize that sometimes there is a benefit of studying and truthfully understanding, you know, what the teacher is talking about and so mm-hmm. forth and so on.
Well, I went – I go – to vacation in Myrtle Beach, and the Maribaba Center is there. And Maribaba died, I think, in the 70s, but he was a prolific writer, and all of his stuff is available online. And I felt that reading his stuff was very helpful for me, just because he was a very realized master that was able to write well and share what you know, what he knew about it. And then, of course, when you go to the Maribaba Center, I don't know if you ever come to America, but the energy is just fabulous. It's just wonderful.
Yeah, that's – it's kind of a it's like when I go to Sri Ramana Ashram in Tiruvannamalai and other places, like even Mahabodhi Temple where the famous Bodhi tree is, the energy there is, you know, is just amazing, you know. And
it
I think that is in all of those places, it's wonderful. And I like what you said that, you know, he was still a prolific writer. You know, a lot of people think that if you're going to be a self-realized person or you're going to attain enlightenment and this and that, you're not going to do things ever again. But that's not really true. You know? You have what you said before, that meditative state of consciousness. You still live your daily life. You move through life.
Right.
But there's a certain ecstasy about living. You know, there's – I remember Daisetsu Suzuki, D.T. Suzuki, Zen master – And he's actually a prolific writer and scholar. He wrote over 100 books, you know. And I think to myself, I think, wow, I can't even get –
that's an amazing feat, right?
I don't even know if I'll get to 10, you know. And he did over 100. But and he meditated a lot, and he, you know, he practiced Zazen. He was a practitioner of the fasting the mind method, and you know, and it's just an amazing feat. And a lot of people think that he's not self-realized, shouldn't he just be in a cave? And it's like, it's not really like that. It's, you know, you continue to live, and he's inspired to write. He's like you said before, he has that guidance, that inner spirit is driving him to write, you know, prolific books that we can all learn from, you know. And I think that that's the role of anyone who really deepens within themselves. They actually become a teacher themselves. They are allowed to share with others, and you know, that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it's amazing. So, well, would you like to, I guess, tell the listening audience a little bit more about how you actually recommend that people do the mind fasting? You know, how would you approach it, given that you have a job and a family and responsibilities? You know, what's the actual? What's it look like?
Well, I've got a lot of methods actually in the book, and I have sort of a system. It's kind of it's a discipline to keep your mind, I guess, not going, you know, from here and there and thinking too much.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very simple method. I call it the KISS method in the book. It's an acronym which means keeping it simple, stupid. So you know, like often we get too busy because we live in a culture that's excessively busy. So keeping it simple is basically built on four fundamental practices that build masterpiece days. So, you know, we should look at each day as a piece of art, you know, all of us. And this is a very simple method. So the four fundamentals are basically meditation, exercise, having a healthy diet, and adequate rest, or we could say getting enough, you know, deep sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And so we should kind of structure if you're living a chaotic busy life, but if you're living a busy enough life which doesn't allow you to fast the mind for extended periods of time, if you put these certain disciplines in practice, then that'll affect your life. So for example, you can wake up in the morning and you can wake up a bit earlier and do 30 minutes meditation before breakfast. You know, it's or 20 minutes if you're super busy, but 30 minutes specifically. And I mean sitting meditation here too. I mean really inquiring within, you know, the practice of mindfulness or just observing the mind or being conscious of your breath, you know, implementing certain practices like that. And then on top of that, you know, healthy diet is obviously a simple discipline that we can follow, but it's obviously difficult because eating is the core, one of the foundations of life. And over the years, I've noticed that, and there's been some research about this, that just having a disciplined diet actually does have an effect on your weight and everything like that, because you know you're not eating certain foods, you're not indulging too much. You're keeping it very simple. So I don't really advocate any sort of diet. Like I don't care if you're a vegetarian or vegan or have a low carb diet or whatever. Just sticking to a specific diet actually keeps your mind not drifting off into temptations and so forth and so on. And exercise is another thing. You know, I speak a lot about cognitive science in my book, and you know, exercise. You know, a lot of people say that when they go for an, like, say, for an intense run or a bike ride, they have a feeling of effortlessness, a feel like a meditative state of consciousness.
Yeah, they this is because they get addicted to it too.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
If they can't and run, this, they get grouchy. if they don't know how to meditate.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
You get the same thing with meditation.
Exactly.
It's endorphins, is what it is. I mean, it's endorphins, right?
Yeah, it is, because you can get the same thing with meditation, and I guess that people who don't sort of focus on meditation, they, like you said, they get addicted to running or bike riding because they just they think of the physical world a lot. But what's actually happening is the prefrontal cortex, where the cold cognition, now that's a term in psychology that means the slow, effortful part of our mind where we have to overanalyze and think, that begins to downregulate or decrease when you run. And this happens also in meditation. That begins to downregulate and decrease. And the more natural part of your cognition, which is called hot cognition in cognitive psychology, is the more natural, the more spontaneous, the more the state of emptiness that you feel in meditation, that's where all of that comes from. So that's why they get addicted to it, because they downregulate that overthinking me aspect of ourselves, and they have this state of effortlessness that, you know, that the great Taoist masters were talking about, you know, thousands of years ago. And
the sports figures call it the zone now.
Yeah, they call it the zone. I know.
Yeah,
they say being in the zone or the flow. And all that's basically happening is the sense of yourself has kind of thinned away a bit. And this is what happens in meditation, and why, you know, we all love meditation too, because, you know, sometimes the sense of self is strong in meditation if you've had a bad experience during the day. But often it thins away, and you can just feel the, you know, the base of your being a lot of the time. But on top of that, on top of exercise, is also, you know, adequate rest. And what I mean by that is, I don't mean chilling out in front of the TV or surfing the internet or scrolling Facebook. I mean actually just completely shutting down the senses from you know, all
deep sleep that restores the physical body. Because
exactly.
You know, people that don't sleep well don't make human growth factor.
No.
They don't. And then they have all sorts of aches and pains, and they don't feel well, and da-da, you know, just, you know, it's a problem.
It's terrible, yeah. And I think that's one of the big reasons that there's so much stress and anxiety and depression in the world, is because that we just don't, you know, people in general just don't get enough sleep. I mean, they work all day. They come home at 10 at night, some people, and they go to bed at midnight, and they're up again at 5. And it's like, well... Yeah.
There's another reason here in the U.S. that you may not have in Thailand, or you may start to have in Thailand, but we have so much electromagnetic interference. The Wi-Fi, the smart meter, even the neighbor's smart meter is a Wi-Fi system, and there's cell towers, there's you know, stuff coming out of satellites. And so I've got something that a friend of mine made called the Rest Shield. And the Rest Shield puts in scalar energy. It basically, for about 20 or 30 feet around it, I've got one right next to me now, it just puts in all this wonderful scalar energy and blocks out the EMF. And everybody says that they sleep really well with the Rest Shield, because I think it's really the EMFs that are causing the majority of the problem. I mean, some people have hormonal problems. They don't make enough melatonin, but generally they can figure that out and take melatonin, where they may have too much norepinephrine hit about 3 o'clock, you know, and then they wake up and can't get back to sleep. I mean, there's various things in insomnia, and as a doctor, we treat all of them. But I just think the EMFs are what is causing people not to have restful sleep in the U.S.
Well, yeah, well, this is why you've got actually people. I only found out about this, I think, last year. They have actually rehabilitation centers away from all EMF and everything like that, you know, in nature.
That's right.
And there's actually people.
The Rest Shield's a lot cheaper. It's $400, okay?
Yeah.
You can continue to work, you know. You don't have to go away. But it's a big problem right now. And you know, we're going to go to 5G on the cell phone soon. It's going to make it worse.
Yeah, that's going to make it worse. Yeah. Well, I only found out about that last year, and I heard that there's actually people who suffer from that. I can't recall the name. There's actually
electromagnetic sensitivity. I actually treat them. They have many free radicals in their blood, and they just can't live in the city. They have to go out into a relatively electromagnetic free zone to even live. But there is a detox you can do. And a friend of mine, this is so interesting. I have a friend named Dr. Commoner, and he actually played with the Eagles, but then he was guided to become a doctor. And he's got spiritual hearing that's just wonderful. And he has developed a product called P2D2 that treats multiple chemical sensitivity. Because usually what it is, you get chemically sensitive before you get electromagnetically sensitive. You know, it's kind of a spectrum. We have too many chemicals, too.
Yeah,
and so getting rid of the free radicals. There's actually a detox for that.
Yeah, well, I tackle it somewhat. I don't tackle the EMF in my book, as you know. I tackle the effects of blue light on us and mm-hmm. how that affects our melatonin. Production. You know, the research out there, and you know, this is one of the key factors. You know, people with insomnia and that. You know, when people are holding their phone in bed at nighttime,
you can put it on airplane mode and not have a problem with it. Yeah,
it's crazy. Yeah, because the brain, it just thinks that it's daytime. You know, mm-hmm. it thinks that it's time to get up and get into action. You know, they speak about this also in traditional Chinese medicine. You know, if you do yang activities at night, so for example, mm-hmm. very active activities, if you're shooting off emails here and there, or you're
can't get to sleep.
Yeah, you can't sleep if you're having a massive conversation with somebody. Mm. You know, it's too active. This is why I talk about the adequate rest part, because we need to start prioritizing our sleep a lot better to sleep better. And that's why I have the practice of digital sunsets in the book. Mm. So that idea is basically at 5 or 6 in the afternoon, you shut all digital devices down and just, enjoy your spouse or enjoy your family and, live a face-to-face life again. And this has a massive effect because you start to produce melatonin a lot earlier in the night, and then you can drift off to sleep easier as opposed to, clutching the smartphone in bed and, a lot of insomniacs, as we know, are chronic on their digital devices. So it's something we need to think about. And there's also other techniques you could do for having good sleep. Meditate before an hour.
Yeah, that's what I do, meditation before bed. I just can't meditate in the morning. I'm not a morning person. I can hardly get out of bed and function in the morning. So I've never been. I mean, I don't care how much sleep. I could have like 15 hours sleep, and I still, when I get up, am not a morning person. Everybody avoids me.
Well, there is, it's we all have our own sort of our daily time frame, don't we? So it's like, some people can't meditate at night, some people can meditate, they prefer the morning, but as long as you're meditating, I think that it's having an effect. It's definitely having an effect on your nervous system. So that'll affect, obviously how you are throughout the day and your sleep, if you like what you do, Susan, just before bed. And, there's just to briefly mention, there's a, it's become popular through serial entrepreneur Tim Ferriss. There's I call it like a nightly cocktail. It's like you have 2 tablespoons of apple cider vinegar, 1 tablespoon of honey mixed into hot water. And for some reason, there's no real scientific research on this, but everyone who has this about half an hour before bed, it just acts as like a sleeping pill. I don't know why that is. I've tried it. My wife she adds chamomile to it, and that even has a better effect. But this is just to mention for all of the people out there who struggle with sleep. But anyway, like that sort of 4 fundamentals I mention in the book to try and as a disciplined method to keep the mind fasted for people who are busy. But also I mentioned the getting away also for a while from society. I think it's very important, at least once or twice a year, to get away for a couple of weeks and completely digital detox, eat clean food, no processed food,
just rest, dedicate it.
Dedicate it to self-care. You know, I think one of the problems in the world now is
I have to do it four times a year now. I'm 62, and twice a year isn't enough. I've been guided to take four vacations a year. No, really, it's true. I mean, I would.
Yeah.
I'm pretty much a workaholic just because I love to work. But if I don't take those four vacations, my health is not as good.
No, it's true. It's true, and I think that. Even, you know, if we lived in a realistic society, probably we could do more than four vacations a year, you know, but a lot of people's jobs don't allow that. You know, a lot of people only get 3 or 4 weeks a year, and it's tough, but, you know, but I think that it's very important. Like what you said, Susan, four times is great. Like that's giving yourself time to shut down from the world and focus on self-care, allow the body to heal and the mind to heal. At a fundamental level, and you know, I've done 4 months in India before, so, and you know, switched off from everything, and it was one of the greatest times of my life, actually. But you know, you don't have the anxiety of emails or social media and all of these sorts of things, and it's something that people have really got to, you know, a lot of people, the problem is when they do take a vacation, they take the world with them. And I think that's not really a vacation. That's kind of just you're not at your job, but you've brought your job.
You're still working.
You're still working. You brought your job to Fiji or wherever it is you've gone to. You know,
so
I think that's.
Yeah, sometimes I do that because you know, every day the patients are having problems. So, you know, I still have to tell them what to do and not to do. So,
yeah,
but anyway, hopefully it doesn't take the whole day. So. Now we're coming up on the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information?
Yeah, sure. My website is my name, jasongregory.org. So you can find a lot of information out there. My Twitter is just at jasongregory33. I'm on Facebook, and you'll find me also on YouTube. It's YouTube/OneWorldWithin. And I have a show on there called Enlightenment Today, which I film every now and again for the listeners. And yeah.
Great.
That's it. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Susan. It was wonderful.
Thanks for getting up early in Thailand. That's good.
Thank you for waiting up as well.
Yeah, no problem. Well, we've been interviewing Jason Gregory. His latest book, Fasting the Mind, Spiritual Exercises for Psychic Detox. Next week we'll have Dr. Mark Thurston on Discovering Your Soul's Purpose, and then Tom Palandino, Scalar Energy. Thanks a lot for joining us. Please join us next week.